You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday the 15th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I've got three news stories today and I'm not sure we will actually get through all of them. The first one comes from Britain. Politically correct councillors are set to spend £186,000 worth of taxpayers' cash renaming a 300-year-old road despite no evidence that it has racist connotations. The road itself is called Black Boy Lane. Now, we keep hearing about how we need to change the names of things, we need to pull down statues, we need to recontextualise things, and this is all because the City of London and the multicultural cities do not reflect the new type of people that are living there. We are told by Sadiq Khan that we need to change these road names so that they reflect the diversity that is there now in London. And yet here you have a road that is named Black Boy Lane. It's quite clearly named after blacks, even if it's not actually named after blacks, surely they're going to look at that and think that road there is named after me. And yet here they are wanting to pull it down. It just seems so ludicrous to me that this is exactly what they have been calling for and saying that there isn't enough of. And this has been there for 300 years and they want to pull it down. Labour-run Haringey Council decided to change the name of Black Boy Lane in West Green, North London, last year after the Black Lives Matter protests, but residents are firmly against it. Well, isn't that saying Black Lives don't matter if you're going to change the name of something which makes people think of black people? And another point here is the residents are completely against this, and they don't seem to be paying any attention to what the residents and the people want. In Bristol, the Bristolians were polled as to whether they wanted to get rid of their Stuart Colston statue, and every time they had a vote on it, the Bristolians said, no, we don't want to get rid of our statue. Stuart Colston was a great man. He built most of Bristol. He built hospitals, left money for the poor. He was a really, really good man. Of course, we don't want to pull his statue down. So because democracy said, keep the statue, the mob decided to pull the statue down, and they were praised for that. And the police officer that allowed it to happen was praised for that. And the BBC made documentaries talking about how wonderful it was. And yet the actual people of Bristol, they didn't want that to happen. The only people that wanted the statue to be pulled down were extreme left-wing activists. And you've got the same here. You've got the people that live in this street who are quite happy with the name of it, Black Boy Lane, and yet they're being told it has to be changed and it's going to cost nearly £250,000 to do that. Labour says it will provide a voluntary £300 payment to the 183 homes impacted by the proposal to call it La Rose Lane, after local poet John La Rose. So what they're hoping to do is they're hoping to actually bribe the residents there into accepting this change in the name. But of course, in the history books, when you look in the history books and you read about something that happened in Black Boy Lane, you won't be able to find it because it will no longer be called that. It will now be called La Rose Lane. And I'm guessing John LaRose is probably black, but what has he ever done for London? What has he done for that road? That road will have been named after somebody important, the same as places are named after people like Stuart Colston. They're named after important people. And Black Boy Lane, it seems, was actually named after King Charles II. The authority will also spend £50,000 on a salary for a support and administration officer to help the residents affected. Imagine that, £50,000 to go to a support and administration officer because they're changing the name of a road. I mean, that's real jobs for the boys, isn't it, that one? I'm sure that's going to be very, very hard work for him for the year, just overseeing the change of a name for a road. Alongside other costs, such as replacing signage, the project will cost an estimated £186,000. Hundreds of streets in England and Wales are at risk of being renamed by councils over fears they have links to slavery and colonialism, according to a report from think tank Policy Exchange. Well, newsflash, the whole world has links to slavery and colonialism, not least the entire continent of Africa. If Africans had not sold their fellow countrymen as slaves, the slavery industry would never have existed in the white world. It may have existed in the Arab world. The Arabs did go out and snatch people. They came to Europe and snatched people from the shores of Europe, and they went into Africa and they snatched people and they turned them into slaves. White people never did that, though. White people bought the slaves fair and square from the African chiefs who were selling them. And if Africa wanted to do away with slavery, all Africa had to do was make it illegal. It's not like they were being forced to do this at gunpoint or anything like that. It was their system of making money. It was their way of looking after themselves. They didn't have a civilization of their own, and yet they did require feeding and housing, and the best way to do that was to sell their services, essentially sell them for being employed by the slave owner, who had to provide all these things for them in exchange for the work that they would do. And as we learned the other week, it actually cost the workers, the employers, it cost them more money to actually pay for the slaves than it did for them to hire workers. So the slaves were better looked after than the workers that were being paid wages, something that most people don't bother to think about when they're looking at these issues. But there are links to slavery everywhere, and it's white people, particularly the British, that actually did away with it. Haringey Council is unsure about the context of the street's name, and historians say that it is likely to have come from a former pub nearby called the Black Boy, which was the nickname for King Charles II. And of course, here we get to the reason why the Afrocentrists like to try and claim that there have been black people in Britain all these years, because they will say things like, King Charles II was black. Didn't you know that? He was known as the Black Boy. They say this about the Black Prince. There are all sorts of characters in European history which have the prefix black before their name, and it's usually to do with their hair or the type of armour that they wore, or they may have been a bad person. King Charles II, I think he was beheaded, so that may be why they called him the Black Boy. But you have this prefix before lots of different names for people throughout European history, and it's not because they were black Africans, and yet Afrocentrists will try and claim that they were. So this street was actually named after the king, and the king's name was also taken by the local pub. So there's a history there. There's a 300-year-old history there, and that's why it's given this name, so that people remember that history. That's far better than giving it the name of some local poet who's never been heard of before in history. Sharon David, 55, a black woman who has now lived on Blackboy Lane for more than 40 years, said, "No one has said anything about the name before. Why all of a sudden now? Because of the Black Lives Matter movement? Changing a street name is not the answer. The money could literally be donated to fight actual racism." Ann Taylor, 48, who has lived on the road for 14 years, said, "This ridiculous amount of money could be spent more wisely." Well, this is fighting racism, isn't it? This is what Black Lives Matter tell us. The way to fight racism is to just wipe out all the representations of white people everywhere and replace them with representations of black people. Of course, that's not going to get rid of racism. The only way to get rid of racism is to separate the races so that there can be no discrimination. And that way, you're not taking away from anybody, are you? In actual fact, you're just giving to everyone. You're giving everybody the right to freedom of association, something that was taken away from us when we were told that we could no longer employ who we wanted. We could no longer sell our houses to who we wanted. We could no longer organize in groups in the way that we wanted. We had our freedom of association taken away from us. If we were to be given our freedom of association back, that would eliminate racism, wouldn't it? That's the way to get rid of racism. Eldridge Culverwell, a Labour councillor who grew up in South Africa during apartheid, believes the decision to rename the road is short-sighted. The 70-year-old said, "They say Blackboy Lane has racist connotations, but I grew up in racist South Africa, and this is rubbish." I mean, what racist connotations are there? What it is saying is that it's not racist, is it? If they were racist, maybe they would use a racial slur, but they're not. They're calling it Blackboy Lane. Anybody black is going to walk past there and think, great, that road is named after me, aren't they? And it's exactly what they've been calling for and saying it doesn't exist anywhere. And of course, it doesn't exist anywhere because multiculturalism has only existed for the last 70 years. So when you get the odd anomalies like this, you would think that they would praise them, not try and pull them down. Some 72% of the residents who responded to a consultation last month are firmly against the name change. And 55% of those in the St. Anne's ward, which Blackboy Lane is a part of, do not want the proposal to go ahead. Councils can change the name of a road without consulting the residents who live on the street, and their only method of redress is to appeal to a court. Policy Exchange is calling on ministers to introduce a democratic right to let them have a say on proposed name changes. And if they were to do that, they wouldn't be able to change any of these names because people are usually quite happy with the name of the place where they're living. I mean, that may have been the reason why they moved there, is because they liked the name of the street. They liked the name of the place. Who are these newcomers to just decide that they're going to change the names of places? They're going to change who it is on the statues. They're going to just replace all the people that were there before. That's what this is about. It's really about replacing everything that white people have built, all the reminders that white people were involved, and replacing them with the newcomers, representations of the newcomers. And that's exactly what Sadiq Khan explains it as. He says he wants to replace all these things with representations of the new people that are in London now. And that means he wants to replace the statues with people that look like him, which is exactly what conquerors do when they conquer other countries. They put up statues of themselves and they name places after themselves. It is so obvious what is going on here. This is the way that Sadiq Khan sees this. He sees this as non-whites taking over London, and he is the mayor of London, so he is effectively legally in charge of London, and now because of that he wants to change all these things so to put his mark upon London and say this is no longer a white capital, this is a multicultural capital, meaning it's a non-white capital. 60% of London is now non-white. Communities Secretary Robert Jenrick is believed to want local authorities to obtain the approval of a supermajority of residents. Councillor Joseph Agiofor, leader of Haringey Council, said its proposal seeks to ensure that our monuments, buildings, place and street names are reflective of our values and the culture and diversity in our borough. So he's saying exactly the same, isn't he? He's saying that the monuments, the buildings, all of them have got to reflect the values of diversity, which means that they've got to look like diversity. It means that they've got to reflect black people and non-whites instead of the people that actually built the borough. Well, let's move on to another subject here. We'll head over to America for this news story. An illegal alien charged with murdering four Americans is looking to evade the death penalty by classifying himself as intellectually disabled. And of course, the illegal alien is non-white, and the four Americans that were murdered, they are all white. Wilbur Ernesto Martinez Guzman, a 20-year-old illegal alien from El Salvador, was charged with murdering 56-year-old Connie Kuntz, 74-year-old Sophia Renkin, 81-year-old Gerald David, and his 80-year-old wife, Sharon David, in January 2019, when prosecutors said he was attempting to steal money from his victims to buy more methamphetamine. Of course, these are all elderly victims that he has murdered here. Now, Martinez Guzman's attorneys seek to classify him as intellectually disabled so that he can evade the death penalty. The attorneys have appealed their case to Nevada's Supreme Court, claiming that they need more time to gather evidence that their client is intellectually disabled. Now, this excuse of being intellectually disabled has actually been about for some time. And in Florida, if you have an IQ that is lower than 70, you can make the defense that you are intellectually disabled and you should not be given the death penalty. Now, when you're looking at white people and you say, well, if somebody's below 70 points IQ, then they are officially retarded. And this is why we have this cutoff point of 70 points. And that would be perfectly fine if everybody was white, because you could say, well, it wouldn't really be just to have a death penalty for people that are retarded. But the problem is, if you're going to say that that applies to everyone, then you've got lots of countries in the world where their average IQ is under 70. Here are a few of them. Swaziland, Dominica, Cameroon, Sao Tome and Principe, Gambia, Lesotho, Haiti, Liberia, Gabon, Saints Kitts and Nevis, Guinea-Bissau, Saint Lucia, Ethiopia, Angola, Mozambique, and Equatorial Guinea. Equatorial Guinea has an average IQ of just 59. That's 50 points lower than some of the brightest countries in the world. 49 points lower than Hong Kong and Singapore. And yet we are inviting these peoples into our countries with these incredibly low IQs, and then we're saying if they carry out heinous crimes, we're not going to give them the death penalty because they can't possibly be guilty. Of course, they are guilty, but the reason is that this is their average IQ. This is the way they are meant to be. It means they're not retarded, and I'm not saying that people from Equatorial Guinea or people from Ethiopia, I'm not saying they are retarded by having this low IQ. And the reason they're not retarded is because that is their average IQ. That is what they are meant to be. They are a different race to whites. Now, we have a lot of things that are associated with a low IQ, and one of them happens to be crime. Studies consistently reflect the fact that chronic or repeat criminal offenders have a lower average IQ than non-offenders. This is true among both juvenile repeat offenders, who average about 92, and adult repeat offenders, who average about 85. IQ tests are normed for a population to 100. Every few years, the tests are renormed due to IQ drift, which tends to be upwards, commonly referred to as the Flynn effect. The 15-point difference between the norm for the general population and that of the chronic offending adults is known as one standard deviation. Now, African Americans, their average IQ is 85. It's the IQ of the average adult repeat offender. And when we look at these countries like Ethiopia that have an IQ of something like 67, just think of how crime-prone these people are going to be. And we have plenty of Ethiopians that are coming into Britain, plenty of Somalians that have this low IQ. Look at the number of Somalians that they have in Minnesota, in America. It's effectively importing a people into your country that are very, very much likely to carry out crimes. And it's just naturally the way that they are. And these average IQ tests, or the average IQ of these people that we can find by doing these tests, this predicts that they're going to be crime prone. More evidence comes from a study conducted in the Texas prison system, which found that more than 20% of criminal offenders had an IQ below 80. IQs at such a level begin to seriously impede a person's chances at life success, and it is thought that a life of crime then becomes an alternative, although dangerous and risky, path for such persons. Additionally, those who have IQ scores around 80 and below have significant problems in balancing short-term versus long-term desires. This is sometimes referred to as the ability to delay gratification and is related to time preference. For example, I want what I want and I want it now by any means necessary versus I want X but will work slowly, methodically and legally or morally to attain it. You know, this is the reason why we've had such an increase in crime in countries that have had a huge increase in people coming in from Africa in particular. But it's any country that actually has an average IQ that is going to be 90 or under, they're going to be particularly crime prone. And if they come from a country where their IQ is under 70, it means that in America, if they carry out murder and they should have been given the death penalty, then it means that they're going to be let off. This is not, however, to say that those of moderate to high IQ do not commit crimes. The presumption here is that those of higher IQ tend to commit crimes which they are able to conceal or are harder to detect for a host of reasons. But chronic offenders do tend to be involved in far more physical crimes: burglary, assault, battery, carjacking, drunk driving accidents, homicides, and the like. And I think we can add rape to that as well. So it's the lower IQs that are going to be involved in the violent crimes. And they're going to be let off as well because we refuse to acknowledge the fact that we have these differing average IQs between the races. Because we refuse to accept the reality of race, we have caused so many problems for our civilization, problems that could all be solved if we would just separate. And I've got one more news story that I'd like to get into today. This one comes from Sweden. The Lund University has found that the majority of convicted rapists in Sweden are of migrant backgrounds, and nearly half of rapists were born abroad, in a landmark study, which is one of the very first of its kind in the high migration level nation. The study, which was published online on February the 22nd, looked at a total of 3,039 convicted rapists and found that 59.3% of the convicts came from migrant backgrounds, and that's first and second generation migrants. What does this mean? It means that if Sweden had not had this migration policy over the last 20 years where they have invited in the third world, It would mean that 60% less women would have been raped. Just think about that. Because of the Swedish government's policy, we have had all these rapes happen. That's the way that you have to look at this, because if these people hadn't been there, if the Swedish government had not invited these people into Sweden, these rapes wouldn't have happened. These women would not have been raped. 60% of all the rapes have been carried out by these newcomers that the Swedish government invited in. For those offenders born outside of Sweden, 47.8% in total, 34% come from North Africa and Middle Eastern regions, while 19% came from sub-Saharan Africa. So a lot of these are going to be Muslims as well. Just under a third of the offenders, or 32%, were on some form of government welfare program, while 38% were said to have low levels of education. Well, of course, they're going to have low levels of education because they have this low average IQ. So they're not just a risk that they're going to be raping the Swedish women, they're also sponging off the Swedish government with these government welfare programs. A third of them are all on government welfare. Where is the benefit to this? Where is this so-called strength that is supposed to come from diversity? When you've got this large portion of these people are just going out there raping and taking money off the government. The authors of the study noted the paper came across a background of rising levels of rape in Sweden and lamented the lack of other research on the backgrounds of convicted rapists, saying, "Unfortunately, studies on rape offenders' characteristics in a Swedish context are absent, and as far as we are aware, there is only one previous study which has evaluated this issue in regards to adult male-on-female rape offenders." The other study cited is a 2020 study from researchers at Malmö University, which looked exclusively at cases in the city of Malmö and also found that the majority of rapists, 71%, were from migrant backgrounds. And of course, you could say, well, Malmö is majority non-white, so you would expect the rapists to be majority non-white. But when you look at the whole of Sweden and you realise that 50% of all the rapists are non-white, then you can see that they are actually massively overrepresented. And it's not just in the areas that have more non-whites in than Swedes. The author said, "Our findings are of particular importance for crime preventative efforts. Very little, however, is known about the association between rape and different contextual factors among immigrants in Sweden." And they called for more studies to better understand the issue. As early as 2017, the overrepresentation of migrants in cases of gang rape was being reported on, with research indicating that 85% of all those involved in gang rapes were foreign in origin. So 85% of the gang rapes in Sweden would not be happening if it wasn't for the government's immigration policy. A year later, Swedish newspaper Expressen reported that almost every man convicted of gang rape from 2016 to 2017 had a migrant background. The study was followed just months later by another report, this time published by newspaper Aftonbladet, that confirmed the vast overrepresentation of migrants in gang rape cases. Sweden was one of the most enthusiastic adopters of mass migration during the mid-2010s Europe migrant crisis, a significant event in the nation's history, which has radically altered the constitution of the country. A nation of just 10 million souls, Sweden issued 1.2 million residency permits to new migrants in 10 years, meaning that by 2020, one-fifth of all Swedes were foreign-born. One-fifth of the people in the country are carrying out 50% of the rapes and 90% of all the gang rapes. And just in case you think that these figures might not be right and it could just be because they're being persecuted or oppressed in Sweden, maybe the Swedes are being racist to them, we can have a look around the world at what the other rape rates are like. Rape rates only count those that are reported to the police, of course, so they could actually be a lot more. And around the world, rape and sexual assault are grossly underreported. But the 10 countries with the highest rape rates based on the number of rapes per 100,000 people are: number 1, South Africa, 132.4 rapes per 100,000 people. Botswana, 92.9. Lesotho, 82.7. Bermuda, 67.3. Sweden, 63.5. Suriname, 45.2. Costa Rica, 36.7. Nicaragua, 31.6. Grenada, 30.6. Saints Kitts and Nevis, 28.6. And of course, we did hear Saints Kitts and Nevis as one of the countries with the lowest IQs in the world, and that is at number 10 in the highest rape rates in the world. But you will notice that the only country that was white in that top 10 of the worst countries for rape is Sweden, of course, because it has imported all these people that are much more likely to rape than the actual Swedes are. South Africa has the highest rape rate in the world, with 132.4 reported incidents for every 100,000 people. South Africa's sexual violence crime rates continue to rise, despite enacting the Criminal Law Amendment Act in 2007. The South African Medical Research Council conducted a survey reporting that approximately one in four South African men admitted to committing rape. 25% of the black South Africans admit to committing rape. And at the moment in Britain, we have all these white women complaining and protesting that they are not safe on the streets, and what we need to do is we need to lock all the men up. And if you point out to them that there are certain groups of men that are far more likely to rape than others, you'll get accused of being a racist. When you try to actually do something about this and say that policy should actually be based on biological reality, you're accused of being a rapist. But the fact is, if you want to lower the number of rapes, if you want to lower the number of murders, if you want to get the violent crime rate back down to how it used to be 60 or 70 years ago, the only way to do it is to separate the races. And everybody would be so much happier. The blacks would be so much happier. The Muslims would be so much happier. And the whites would certainly be so much happier. I mean, this is what Black Lives Matter are calling for, isn't it? They want black teachers, black judges, black police. Well, the way to do that is simply to separate the races and give us our freedom of association back. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.